Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1993, features three prominent intellectuals in the field of neuroscience: Dr. Timothy Tully, former senior staff investigator at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory; Dr. Eric Kendell, former senior investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute; and Dr. Patricia Goldman-Rackick, professor of neuroscience at the Yale University School of Medicine. They discuss the results of their experiments on short-term and long-term memory. We hope you enjoy today's episode and stop back next week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
It strikes me that in considering the study of learning and memory, I think all three of us find ourselves in a really fascinating phase of the field that what really has intrigued us and brought us into the neurobiology of learning and memory is that we're interested in how human beings learn, how they acquire new information, how they hold on to it. But each of us has come into the field from a different experimental perspective. Mm-hmm. You, Tim, are working on Drosophila, and you, Pat, working on monkeys. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, Pat, when you first started, whether you thought you'd be doing experiments that are as deeply involved in learning and memory as they have turned out to be.
Well, actually, it comes as somewhat of a surprise to me that I'm actually studying learning and memory in the way that we're studying it now. And in the early days, when I began to study the cortex, the cerebral cortex, and the highest area, the frontal lobes, I thought that it was impossible to understand the neural basis of memory, because I had been accustomed to the very widespread belief that this was too complex a subject, especially the cortical contribution to memory. And perhaps if you recall, in the even in the early 70s, there was no real animal model of what you're now studying in terms of hippocampal contribution to memory. So I more or less accepted this dogma that, well, it's too complex. And I thought, well, I'll just be satisfied with looking at more basic things and working out, for example, the anatomy or the connections of the frontal cortex or how it develops and when it develops and such questions as that. And little by little, the information that we were gathering over these years without our sights on understanding memory came together in such a way as they made me start thinking, well, what is this connection for? What is this doing? What is that doing? And as we'll probably discuss during this conversation, a lot of things came together that made it really a wonderful opportunity and realization that we're studying the neural basis of a memory phenomenon. Now, what about you?
Your work is on let me just explore own thinking a little bit first. Your work is on prefrontal cortex.
Right.
Now, I don't remember the history of that cortex sufficiently well. Were people aware of the fact that it might be involved in working memory, as you've been able to show recently?
Well, actually, that's another very penetrating question, because another reason why I didn't think that we could be studying memory is that people were not thinking about the prefrontal cortex in terms of memory. Mm-hmm. They were invoking the most, global concepts such as personality, planning for the future.
This was the period just after the lobotomy era in which people were really impressed.
First of all,
how little sometimes happened as a result of lesions.
Well, that's interesting, since we're having our conversation at Columbia and some of those studies
that's
were done
here. The Greystone Project.
There were several things happening. One is that it was after the frontal lobotomy era, and there was the widespread belief that the frontal cortex had nothing to do with cognitive or intelligent behavior. And that was very much supported by a very little abstract by Donald Hebb, who otherwise is quoted all the time for being having the seminal contribution to studying conditioning and the basis, neural basis of conditioning, he had done a study in which he obtained IQ scores of patients with frontal lobotomies, and they had no change in their IQ scores. And that just killed the field. Hmm. That killed the idea that the frontal cortex had anything to do with these higher order things. So actually, frontal lobe research went into a real decline, probably on the basis of that one abstract, among other things. And people were not studying it. So I was really out there all by myself, continuing to study that. But again, without the thought that it would lead to where it's led.
Right.
And now, the idea about working memory came forward when actually the field of cognitive psychology became more cognitive. And they started to study memory processes in humans and to split apart what the conventional distinction between long-term and short-term memory. Now, I'm sure, as you know, short-term memory was thought of as kind of an avenue into long-term memory, and it was interesting as a entry point. But it wasn't thought of as having anything, as a readout, exactly, or having any kind of dynamic quality, or having a function of its own other than serving long-term memory. But people like Alan Baddeley, some British psychologists, and others before him, came to the conclusion that short-term memory was something different, and it could be dissociated from long-term memory. And they started to think of it as a more dynamic process. And there's not a great deal of agreement on what working memory is among the cognitive scientists right now. But at least one very important aspect of it is that it is thought of as a scratch pad and a temporary memory system from which the information need not go into long-term memory, but could serve its own purpose. That is, it's the ability to recall information from long-term store, bring it to mind, and manipulate that information, such as in a mental arithmetic problem,
yes,
or actually in conversation or in comprehension. It is the, I think of it this way, the glue which connects these moments in time so that you have continuity to your conscious experience, so that, for example, you can recall the subject of the sentence by the time you get to the object of the sentence. And then as soon as you utter a sentence, you've completely forgotten it. As soon as you do a mental arithmetic problem, you forget it. So it is kind of like, it's really information processing. And it's just as important that we erase as that we retain the information. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a different mechanism mm-hmm, mm-hmm. than the long term.
Yes.
And maybe you
yes.
ought to
yes.
talk about
it. What I like about it is the conception that you presented, for example, in your last seminar in Copenhagen, which I found so interesting, is that it's really sort of the output system for
right.
various kinds of memory process, that we can store it in long-term memory. But if I recall your name, Pat Goldman-Rakic, it is through a frontal lobe mechanism. The other thing I find interesting about your work is that it brings together in primates and monkeys really a very advanced form, sort of what we would call sort of a cognitive neuroscience approach. It brings together mm-hmm. fairly sophisticated advanced psychology mm-hmm. of the kind that one clearly sees in you and me with cellular neurobiology. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Tim Tully really represents the other extreme. He really works in a very simple animal and looks at how genes affect learning and behavior. And I wonder whether, you know, you might tell us how you got involved and how your approach melds with the others.
Yeah. It's actually a good framework to answer that question. And to begin, I've always been involved. When I was an undergraduate in college, I took a course on the genetic basis of behavior, where the professor involved, Dr. Jerry Hirsch, worked on the genetics of learning and memory. And I was fascinated and intrigued from that moment on and have pursued it ever since. Having said that, the focus that we always had was genetics. And what that means is that we fundamentally believed that genes that make proteins and other gene products had to, in some way, direct the biological process that ultimately gave rise to a functioning brain and to learning and memory processes. So it's been from what you might say the bottom-up perspective that we've tackled the problem. Now, focusing on genetics, what we have to have as an experimental tool is genetic manipulation and genetic tools to bring to bear on the problem. And in this century, the organism that has kind of stepped forward as one with a lot of genetic tools is the tiny little fruit fly Drosophila. As powerful as they are for genetic tools, for a long time it was not known that they could learn anything. Mm-hmm. And in the early 70s, finally a convincing demonstration that flies were capable of learning something emerged from Seymour Benzer's lab at Caltech. And to understand what that is and ultimately how it relates to memory, we have to step back to the beginning of the century when a Russian by the name of Pavlov worked on dogs. And most people, I'm sure, have heard of Pavlov's dogs. What Pavlov did fundamentally was that he designed an experimental procedure that reduced learning down to a very basic aspect, which was the association of two stimuli in time. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not the only form of learning, of course, but it was a basic element of a very fundamental kind of learning. And to me, the genius of what Pavlov did at the time was that he extracted the procedure so that it could be applied to any species, from man down to the tiny fruit fly.
I agree with you. And I think that we don't hear Pavlov cited enough because, in fact, isn't he the one of the earliest to have brought to our attention the coincidence of a input and two stimuli coming together in time,
yes,
which is the basis of the association?
Yes.
But what he really did was he took the idea that the empiricist philosophers were dealing with, that learning involves an association of ideas, and did what any good biologist did. He put it into a context when we can really study it, and showed that you can study it by associating stimuli.
But I think he also emphasized the temporal coincidence.
Yes.
In a way
that no one had appreciated
before.
It's
really fundamental for what is now being studied in physiological terms.
Absolutely. And what has emerged in this century is first that this basic idea of associating two events in time is in fact extremely complex. Psychologists have spent this century working out just a myriad of little properties, we could say, of this kind of learning. And it has ramifications into all different kinds of tasks that we learn to do and that we learn not to do. That's one of the fun aspects. The other that sort of emerged in this century as well is that many different kinds of organisms can do this very basic form of learning. And what I'm sure that we will hear of in detail from Eric in this conversation is that what that seems to represent now is that there are some very conserved molecular events that underlie these simple changes involved with learning. And that also is what unites the molecular cellular approach of Eric and his group with that of the fly genetics approach, that genes are the molecules that can be inherited and passed on from generation to generation. Now, to sort of link this, your question, to that of memory, what I can say from work that we've been doing in my lab in the last several years is that it appears as though information processing of this simple form of learning in flies is following all the same kinds of rules as information processing in higher organisms in man. In particular, there seems to be a short-term memory, which is very labile and can be disrupted by various kinds of insults or distractions from the environment. And that there's also a very long-lasting for a fruit fly, and much more stable form of memory that also exists in flies. And the fun of what we do at this very basic molecular level is that work that Eric has been doing and the work in flies now seems to be following a similar course in the kinds of mechanisms that are involved. And perhaps you would like to tell us a little bit about that.
As a matter of fact, one of the things that strikes me, although we didn't plan it this way, is that there really is substantial overlap between our work.
There is.
And we could really, and in a very elementary way, present the coherent view of one component of the learning process, because many of the molecules that we work with in Aplysia, the sea snail, are not only involved in Drosophila, but you've shown very nicely in the actions of dopamine, one of the major transmitters in the mammalian brain, activates the same second messenger system as are involved in fruit fly and Aplysia, and shows the basic universality of biological processes.
So what's a second messenger system?
We've been interested in cyclic AMP, but let me stick back a little bit. That is, my work relates really to what the two of you have been talking about as sort of a bridging system. I've been working on the snail, Aplysia, and my lab has been interested in the question, what kinds of cellular changes occur in the nervous system when an animal learns? And we found that a critical thing that happens is that synaptic connections, the communication points between nerve cells, change, and that reinforcing stimuli of the kind that Pavlov describes act to strengthen connections, and they do it by activating intracellular messenger systems, and a particularly important one for certain kinds of learning is cyclic AMP. And you, Tim, have shown very nicely in some of your experiments that these are involved in certain kinds of learning processes. And there is also the evidence from Pat's work that that is involved. Now, needless to say, in something as complicated as the brain, other second messengers are also involved, and there are various kinds of learning processes that use other second messenger systems.
You know, it strikes me another thing that we all have in common is a reductionistic attitude to what we're studying. And yet, without losing sight of the levels from that relate to what we're studying. And I think it's really exciting that we know in the mammalian brain about, say, the connections between the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus. And that when an animal, such as a monkey, and I suppose even a rat, and certainly a human, does a memory test, and perhaps particularly a working memory test, both the hippocampus and prefrontal cortex are activated. So they're part of a circuit. And you can start to imagine how input from, say, a cortical region to the hippocampus might be physiologically relevant to the events, the cellular events that happen in the hippocampus that could lead to long-term potentiation. Because after all, that's the input.
Right.
And likewise, the output could also, of the hippocampus to the cortical area, is something that isn't studied enough. I think we might agree, looking at the work that's being done in behaving animals and mammals, has to be understood in terms of how you get information out. You know, it's one thing. We need to think more in terms of process, as some of our colleagues have emphasized. There's consolidation, which I think is very close to what you're studying, and storage. And then what good is it if you can't get it out? You have to have a mechanism for retrieving it. Otherwise, why should we store all this information if we don't have a way of reading it out, as you say, read out? And it occurs to me that the things that people are interested in, like intelligence and intelligent behavior, actually comes down to understanding memory, because we could, my favorite definition of intelligence is the ability to bring the appropriate information to bear at the moment. And that's how memory enters cognition. It's the range and pertinence of the of all the information you have in your long-term store. What you bring out is very significant to the guiding the behavior that you're going to engage in at any given moment.
And sort of a selective retrieval. Yeah.
And even though it's important to have good memory, and which I must confess I don't have. But anyway, I mean, it's important to be able to remember a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It's also important to remember the right things at the right moment and to get into that storage box and bring it out. And that's where I think the cortical and hippocampal interactions are going to be tremendously important. Now, I know we don't have that in the Drosophila, but that I think that the cellular mechanisms are apt to be very, very similar.
Also, I think it's useful to make sort of the distinction between different forms of learning.
And processes.
And processes. For example, the distinction between implicit and explicit forms of learning.
Oh, yes. I want to talk about that.
I mean, what Tim described very nicely before, Pavlovian's classical conditioning, which is sort of one of the higher forms of implicit forms of learning, to which simpler forms like sensitization, habituation belong, don't involve hippocampus, probably don't necessarily involve frontal cortex. They involve the particular sensory and motor system that is involved. And that can be studied in any animal that has an evolved nervous system. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, things that involve remembrances about people, places, and things, conscious participation, involve hippocampus, temporal cortex, and frontal cortex. And probably can only be studied, or at least best be studied, in mammals.
I totally agree with that conception, because I think that we all share in the basic mechanisms of sensitization, habituation, and probably conditioning, I would assume. But then when you come to this higher order business, it gets much
new,
more elaborated.
New structures come into question. What was going to be interesting, which I don't think we're going to know for another 5 or 10 years, is that it's perfectly conceivable that even though the circuitry is much more complicated and involves these newly evolved structures like the hippocampus and association cortices, that the cellular molecular mechanisms that are involved might still share components in common. For example, one of the things that has always struck me, and perhaps you would comment on this, is that in the old work by Flexner, Barandas, and Squire, and others, which looked at the inhibitors of protein synthesis and how it affected long-term memory without affecting short-term memory, that people looked at tasks that were both implicit and explicit. So here is a fundamental distinction about how long-term memory is stored compared to short-term memory is stored, suggesting that different molecular...
Are you using the terms implicit and explicit as a dichotomy?
Conscious memory. That people looked at tasks that seemed to, you know, in mammals, including in primates, that nevertheless you can peel off a long-term memory process for remembering an object in space, something that presumably involves hippocampus, frontal cortex. But nonetheless can separate it off with a procedure that separates off Tim's form of long-term memory and the implicit form of long-term memory, which are clearly, you know, implicit, simple, reflexive type of learning. So it's possible that the circuitry is much more evolved, that there's much more parallel processing.
Yes,
but if you look at the synaptic changes, that they may nonetheless follow the same rules in elaborate learning as in simple forms of learning.
I think that's an interesting... one of the points that I keep trying to emphasize, but apparently not very well, not judging from your comment, but in general, is I want cell biologists to recognize a little bit more the difference between the working memory, which is basically a where you really have to understand that it's not going anywhere. It's evanescent.
No, I understand that.
No, I know you do. I know you do. But so I'm thinking the same kinds of molecular mechanisms and cellular mechanisms that are really underlying stamping in information might be different. I agree that the, you know, basic cellular machinery might be the same, but I think if we start to think, I just have the feeling that there could be a whole set of new mechanisms, maybe using the same alphabet, but going in a different direction.
You may very well be right, but you're speaking about an additional variant to the memory process. That is the readout
that you've been studying. But I think it's a different thing.
It may very well be. I mean, I think one could argue either point. If I look at your beautiful results, I'm struck with the fact that you use dopamine for regulation and it works to a D1 receptor, and that seems to be cyclic AMP. So even though he and I came into this room from a completely different direction, we immediately recognize your molecules as old friends.
What seems
to be involved in flies are also biogenic amines, as they are in aplysia. So I think that even though you're dealing with a highly evolved, very special, almost human-like working memory, the molecules are nonetheless quite conserved. Now, the circuitry, which really gives the brain its distinctive function, is of course much more elaborate. You have many, many more pathways. They interact in much more complicated ways.
But that allows this process.
Gives degrees of freedom that the molecules can be used in now novel ways because of the fact that you have lots of reentrant pathways, etc. That are present there.
So that seems to be implying in drawing this distinction between cellular processes and circuits, that the brain, certainly of monkeys and of man, is specialized anatomically, that there are different regions of the brain that do different things, and that working memory in prefrontal cortex is that brain part's task, and as such has been designed to be that way.
That's my theory now, that the prefrontal cortex evolved to carry out that process. So, and without it, you don't have that process. You have all the other processes. You have long-term memory. You have adaptation, habituation, all of that. But you're missing this extra component. And this is evident from looking at patients with frontal lesions, with monkeys with frontal lesions, and so on. But it's really...
I think what you're saying is really quite fascinating, because it really... touches a point that I like most about the study of learning. What has always appealed to me about it, looking at it from the point of view of a cell biologist, is that it's a wonderful problem from a cell biological point of view, because you can see in it both universal mechanisms that cells use for doing very routine things, but you see it in a very special context. So often you can uncover really a novel manifestation of a general mechanism. And what you're saying is very much the same thing, that by looking at the frontal cortex, you're going to see, you know, nerve cells, but you're going to see them in a way that you don't see them in other parts of the brain, because they're recruited, as you say, from an evolutionary point of view, to solve this particular task.
The really interesting, another really interesting aspect is that there seem to be many different parallel systems, each organized according to common principles. And for example, I think that makes it possible to see conservation also across species. So for example, in the area of visual processing or odor processing, it's more apt to be similar between primates and mice and rats and aplysia and other animals than in the area of semantic or linguistic or auditory. But the principles might be similar. In other words, if you worked out the basis of olfactory conditioning as you are, they might have very great relevance to human olfactory conditioning.
They're really essentially, I think what we're all saying is, they're really sort of two separate issues in the study of memory. One is the cellular and synaptic mechanisms,
right.
And the other is the circuitry.
Right.
And the circuitry is likely to vary greatly for different learning tasks and for different species, certainly as you get to more mm-hmm. evolved learning,
mm-hmm.
but that the cellular mechanisms are likely to be shared.
Especially for the conditioning, I think, and yeah. Which I believe underlies many of the declarative and non-declarative and implicit, and all of that is based
on... Many have them associated features.
That.
It's
I
a very fundamental...
I think that is very, very fundamental.
Well, and the, another idea that I was leading up to was that when you have a developing brain that does have specialization among the neurons and the circuits mm-hmm. within, it implies that there can be developmental influences and differences among neurons.
Mm-hmm.
So that another emerging idea that all of us are contemplating is to what extent do these processes of learning and memory involve the same kinds of developmental phenomenon that established
right.
the brain in the first place?
Yeah, that really is probably a topic
subject.
For another
yes.
subject, but
yeah.
it is quite fascinating.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
is that, and I think I mentioned this to you in a conversation recently, I really felt for the longest time, really until 5 or 6 years ago,
mm-hmm.
that the brain was pre-programmed to develop along very precise ways, and that the connections that we end up with in the adult brain are determined prior to birth. And we now realize that in many parts
mm-hmm.
of the brain, not in all, certainly
right.
it's true in the spinal cord, right. quite precise connections,
right.
but in many parts of the brain that isn't true,
right.
that the connections are programmed in a very rough way, and learning mechanisms are involved mm-hmm. in the fine-tuning of those connections. So that the solution of learning not only is important for memory processes, but may carry with it this extra bonus.
Well, I think we should come back and talk about this in our next meeting. But I did want to say one thing before we conclude, and that is the fact that we can be thinking about the cellular molecular basis of memory. I really feel we owe a lot to you, Eric, because you inspired that this could be done, even though you really started out with the sea slug but you showed that it could be it could be done showing that it could be done. That was a kind of a stimulus and a role model, really, and in a way, I think everybody, many of us, maybe even I, am trying to emulate you in my own way, in my own system. So I think I just wanted to put that
That's
forward.
That's very, very nice. Thank you very much.
I hope I can get to the cellular basis of working memory.
I must say, I find the two of you an enormous source of inspiration. You were one of the first Spencer Award winners
That's
at Columbia
right.
because
That's
we
right.
regard your work so highly. Mm-hmm. And I was delighted when Tim Tully moved to Cold Spring Harbor to have him close by.
Yes.
And certainly the
nice
work in Aplysia has benefited enormously from the work of Drosophila.
Yeah.
We seem to be converging on you from both directions. You occupy the middle ground of cells.
Absolutely.
The geneticists are coming up and the anatomists are coming
yes,
down.
Yes, and I will feel fulfilled only when... they planned an experiment in Aplysia based on our work in monkeys.
Well, that is coming. As soon
that's
as Aplysia
dopamine.
Develops a frontal cortex.
Dopamine should be the connection.
That's
very good.
Why not dopamine?